Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and for this episode, we have some truly historic coverage coming to you from the Fan Expo 2018, Fan Expo Canada 2018, let me make sure I say that correctly, directly from room 716 at the Metro Toronto Convention Center. And I don't think it's possible to properly do an intro for this episode considering the panel guest that is featured here. Guys, gals, comic fans, this is recorded footage of John Byrne Fan Expo 2018. And I say it's historic because it's going to be, as he said, his last Comic-Con appearance. That could change, but he hasn't been to one of these shows in many, many years. And for those who are listening to this show, you know exactly who John Byrne is. And if you don't happen to know why I'm as excited as I am talking about John Byrne, I say legend all the time. This guy's truly legend. If you like the X-Men, it's because of John Byrne. You may not know that, but it's because of John Byrne. If you like Superman stories from the 1980s, Fantastic Four, not the movies, the comic books, John Byrne. The Avengers, he worked on the Avengers. He's worked on the Incredible Hulk. He's worked on Namor the Submariner. He was a main writer for She-Hulk. The list goes on and on of all the things that he's worked on. And not only did he work on them, he changed the way we think of these characters. Very few people leave as indelible a mark in a medium, in a genre, in an industry as John Byrne has in the comic book industry. Look it up. And on top of that, not only was he extremely prolific and creative, and his art was, and art and storytelling was beautiful, he was a really controversial guy too. So it's exciting to be able to interact with him in some capacity. I had the privilege of being able to ask a few questions in both panels. I've got 2 hours of footage because I went to two different panels with John Byrne. The first day, I was able to go with Aaron Broverman, the host of Speech Bubble podcast, where he, if you enjoy this podcast, definitely check out Speech Bubble. Shout out to Aaron. We got to sit at the front row together for this panel. And then the second panel on Sunday, I was able to go with none other than Mr. Martin Slam Duncan of the Fastball Special, another podcast that's going to have footage from this year's Fan Expo. So I've spoken enough. We're 3 minutes in. You don't want to hear from me. You want to hear from John Byrne, the legend. Without further ado, enjoy. Buckle up. Enjoy the show. John Byrne, ladies and gentlemen. Just an editor's note. Obviously, I recorded from my recorder in the panel. It's not going to be as loud as I am now. So turn the speakers up a little bit so you can hear the full show. And don't forget to email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Rate us on iTunes, as well as follow us on Facebook. And if you do want to buy John Byrne comic books, you want to go to your local comic shop, Cyber City Comics, Steeles and Bathurst. Just look up in the sky. You're going to see the Cyber City in the air. Put in your order for any John Byrne books that they don't have. You will not be disappointed. Without further ado, Fan Expo 2018, John Byrne Panel, Part 1. Welcome.
Officially, please give another warm welcome
to Lapsed
Canadian and comic book legend, John Byrne.
Good day.
You still got it.
I still got it.
First of all, Marvel's really sloppy.
Yeah.
The mess these guys left behind.
I can't believe I'm going.
We need somebody to get to Marvel and help clean the place up, right?
Yeah.
Don't ask anybody from DC.
No,
so John hasn't been to Canada in a long time, and so to celebrate John's return, we prepared nothing. We thought you guys should get a chance to ask John whatever's been on your mind. So we just want to do a general Q&A and let everybody, whatever you might want to ask away. While you're thinking of your questions, I'll ask a quick first one if I can, and then we can start with you. We lost Marie Severin this weekend. I was just curious if you had a relationship with Marie.
Yeah, I knew Marie. She was a really sweet lady about 30 years ago. I had an idea for a Western project, and I called her and asked her if she would ink it. And she said, "Don't you want my brother?" And I said, "No, I want you," because she was just so good and so sweet.
It's funny, a lot of the art tributes were all from Not Brand Eck, and like she was such a better artist than just sort of the funny art.
Yeah.
She was really talented.
But she was so good at the funny art.
Yeah, she was.
That was amazing. I don't know if you ever guys ever saw the sort of 3D map of the Marvel offices that she did, which was just before I started at Marvel, so I'm not on it, you know, but I want to put myself in there.
She did the EC bullpen too, that amazing piece of all the artists.
Yeah. So, all right, somebody had a...
Yeah, let's kick it off. You had a question?
Yes. Yeah, I just had a question about your recent X-Men pages that you posted.
The what?
The X-Men pages that you
had drawn. I'm not sure what you mean. And that's the answer. Anybody else?
What happened to Trio issue 4?
I don't know. There was a brief surge of stuff there, and then it just kind of, you know, didn't sell.
We had big plans for a whole universe there.
Yeah, you know, I was building everything I could possibly steal from Marvel.
Just to quickly jump back to the X-Men question, just so we hit it.
What X-Men question?
If you hadn't seen, John has been playing with some X-Men pages online, so that's led to a lot of speculation. And at this point, it's just great speculation, so... I think most of us would like to see this become a reality, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But we're not here to announce it.
No, we're not. No, there's nothing to announce. CB said he got tingly looking at it. No. Who else?
Yeah, over here in the hat.
Yes, sir. So, did you choose Terry Austin or to be the main anchor for X-Men during your run, or was it something close to that line?
Terry was chosen first.
Okay.
I mean, I wasn't on the book when Terry was chosen. And Archie Goodwin asked Terry, would he do it? And then he set about to get me, because Archie really liked what Terry and I had done on Star-Lord. You know, so, and when Archie contacted me, I said, well, geez, I'd rather have Terry ink me on Marvel Team-Up, because then it'll look like Superman, Spider-Man. Archie goes, no, I want you on X-Men. I said, well, okay. Because I had told him that if Dave left the X-Men and I didn't get it, the halls of Marvel would run red with blood. Whether they were scared or... I got it, so...
So wait, a quick follow-up to that, because everybody always asks for your favorite inker, and I'm not going to do that to you, but what made a good inker for you rather than a bad inker? Who did, like, what sort of things did you like to see from an inker over your work?
I like to see an inker who is faithful, but interpretive. So, for example, those pages that I haven't posted online and don't know about, there's a lot of jungle stuff in the background. It's fairly loose, and I would like the inker to come in and go, oh yeah, this is a leaf, you know, and that kind of stuff. I don't want to have to go, because that's just a waste of time. Might as well ink it myself. Sir?
I know you've been a, you know, established writer, you know, illustrator, drawer, and everything else. This stage in your career, what would you rather do, write or, you know, draw?
Well, I just spent 18 months of really not wanting to draw. Just not wanting to draw. So I didn't. And I referred to myself as unemployed because people were saying, oh, you're retired. No, that's old. I'm not old.
It's also a commentary on IDW's page rates, I think.
Well, there's that. But I just suddenly lost interest in putting pictures in little boxes. And then I did that non-existent X-Men page, and then I did another one, and then I did another one. And then pretty soon I had 20 of them. And suddenly I said, yeah, I guess I can do this again. Okay. And I think a lot of it was I'd gotten tired of my own inking. So doing it in full pencils kind of set the fires alight again. Sir, somebody here had a... Sir.
What were the circumstances in the 1990s allowed for all the crossovers between Marvel and DC?
Well, what happened was a lot of people were flowing back and forth, of course. You know, Marvel people were going to DC, DC. People were fleeing Shooter and ending up at, I've often said, I'm going to go on a slight tangent here. Back in those days when you guys didn't know 3 months in advance what was coming, and the first time anybody found out about the Superman Spider-Man book was when the house ads appeared in the comics. And I figure there were some kids who walked into the local drugstore and there it was on the spinner rack and they didn't know it was coming and their heads must have exploded. And that was, in many respects, the first Superman Spider-Man was the last gasp of old-time comics, because Ross Andrew penciled it, except you may not know this. It was given to Dick Giordano to ink. Dick took it up to the continuity offices where he worked with Neil, and Neil redrew all the Superman figures. He erased Ross's and redrew it. He put it inside the profile that Ross had drawn, but he redrew it. And then there was an editor who went in afterwards and put a white line around all the foreground figures to make them jump, all because people wanted it to be the best book anybody had ever done. And today, well, just what Neil did would make all the lawyers commit harakiri. They just go out of their minds. And yet it produced this just wonderful little moment of time. And then, of course, they had to kind of run it into the ground. I mean, the moment that the crossovers became an ongoing monthly series, what was that called? Amalgam. Whatever that was. No, Amalgam was something else. But anyway, this is what we do in the business. We take something special and just run the wheels off it. So they kind of went away for a while. And luckily, in that span, I got to do... there's nothing happening in here. I got to do Darkseid versus Galactus, which was... And that was fun, because I was at a convention, and George Perez was sitting next to me at our table, and this kid came up and said, "Why didn't you do Darkseid versus Galactus?" And George and I just looked at each other, and said, "How come we don't think of stuff like that?" Holy crap. And then, of course, I got to do one of my all-time favorite jobs ever, which was Batman and Captain America. Yes, you can applaud. But that, even as I was doing those, the whole thing was dying. And then it just some nasty stuff, between Marvel and DC and politics. It's always about politics. One of the reasons I left both of them was just too much stuff. So, sir?
You were doing FF, Avengers, yeah, and X-Men around all the same time.
Yeah.
Which one did you get the biggest kick out of?
Well, my first Marvel comic was Fantastic Four number 5. So to actually, it was a double barrel effect. They said, "Okay, John, you're going to do the Fantastic Four." Cool. That's so great. Oh, by the way, the 5th issue is the 20th anniversary. I'm sorry, what? And Shooter says, "No big deal. Do Fantastic Four the movie." What? do an issue that somebody who's never heard of the book can do. Corey, my friend Corey, who's sitting over there, who got kicked in the head by Captain America in one issue. He and two other friends of mine sat around my apartment back then saying, oh God, what can I do with the 20th anniversary issue? And I think it was Corey who brought up an FF cover, symbolic cover Jack had done, where the FF are in Latveria and doom is like looming over the whole thing. And he said, why don't you do that, but make it real? And I went, yeah, okay, I could, that would be cool. And I immediately saw that double page spread of Dr. Doom, and then I had to work backwards to make it work. But yeah, the Fantastic Four was just a hoot and a half. And you know, I wish it could have gone on longer. You, sir?
Any plans to bring the Next Men back?
No, that's finished.
It is?
That's done. That's, stick a pin in it.
I mean, I do have the pages for an unpublished issue, but...
What? I know my memory is going,
but...
Okay, who's... Sir?
There's been some talk, I think, by the current editor at Marvel about his goal to get back at Marvel. I don't know if that's...
Back at Marvel?
Yeah, this is something I've heard. There's some talk. Anyways...
Who's saying this?
I think CB.
CB? Who's CB? Who's
CB? Yeah,
I don't know.
How do you spell that?
Anyways, my question is whether there's any truth to that or not. What would you, if you were to either work for the major publishers again, maybe whether it be Marvel, what would you like to bring back to modern comics or to those modern characters that we haven't seen in a while? What would you?
I'd like to bring back 1977. Well, I did this thing online that I deny, and the whole point of it was kind of an exercise of my version of Phoenix Didn't Die, and what would I do with that? And because of the way my mind works, I now have a year and a half worth of issues in my head with nowhere to put them. So it's like I have to go back to Marvel because I got to do this or my brain will fry. But you know, I've talked to CB. We had a breakfast business meeting in Boston, and it seemed productive. And I've been screwed over by Marvel twice so far in my career. So, you know, is this going to be a new beginning, or is this going to be three for three? We'll see. You know, I'm such a reasonable, easygoing guy. I don't know why there's ever a problem. Just, you know, I know how to do it right, and they don't. And that's the only quote that will make it onto the internet.
Why is there so few animated series based on X-Men? Is that the question? You probably have to ask Marvel. I think yeah. Marvel probably sees the value in the high dollar, big budget movies more so than the cartoons. But
to work with Stan, Stan is Stan. I mean, everything you know about Stan is Stan, and it's amazing to work with him. You know, it's just come on, John, let's go. Face front, true believer. Yeah.
If I could tell one quick Stan story.
No.
John obviously worked for more with Stan, but just what it was like for me to work with Stan was I wrote a book about comics, and I had a big filmmaker who agreed to write the intro for the book. He had 6 months to write the intro. At the last minute, he stiffed and said, nope, I'm not going to do it. I just can't do it. So I took a complete long shot and just asked Stan if he would write this intro. 2 hours later, I had this full amazing intro in my inbox. So that's what, for me, what it was like to work with Stan. Other people sort of get caught up with thinking that there's something special. Stan just sat down, did the work, and delivered this amazing thing in record time. So
Stan wrote me a fan letter once. You want to wrap your brain around this, you know, 11-year-old kid who picked up his first copy of Fantastic Four in 1962.
And then I'm working on the Fantastic Four, and I don't know how familiar you are, but I did a story called The House That Reed Built that was the trapster trying to break into the Baxter Building, and the Baxter Building all by itself defeating him. And Stan sent me a fan mail. He said, that was a great story. And, you know, I tucked it into my bound volume that has that issue in it. You know.
Stan Lee!
When you worked with Stan on the Silver Surfer issue, yeah. did you have any involvement, you know, on the story back and forth?
I had plotted it, and then we just gave it to Stan and let him be Stan.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the one thing. It was just like, wow, look at this. Yeah. All right, you, sir.
Originally, Kitty was afraid of Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
And how were you going to get them to eventually, I assume,
each other? We would kind of turn that into an ongoing subplot that would last for months, years, you know, just to play with it. And then, of course, we did Days of Future Past where she was okay, and Chris just wrote it that way from then on.
Chris,
And then I left, so there's, you know, nobody steering the character anymore. And she, as I like to say, Kitty went from young Sigourney Weaver to Brooke Shields. As soon as Smitty came on board, it was like, whoa, okay, my kitty's gone.
Watching the old Spider-Man cartoon that was done in Toronto, the one that everybody knows with the music and all that, mm-hmm. Do you think that there will ever be a film done that is based in the 1960s? Because at that time, like looking back now, all those interesting things that happened.
Yeah, that will.
Wouldn't it be a good thing to have Spider-Man come up at that time and then go through all the things in the 60s.
I think that would be a perfect, perfect setting for the Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a Cold War origin, yeah. And, you know, it would be great. And, you know, when the Red Ghost isn't red for the reason he used to be red anymore, I was a sensitive child, I'll admit it. You know, card tricks would give me nightmares. And when issue 12 said, next issue, the Red Ghost, I spent a month sweating bullets because I knew I was going to be terrified. I knew I was going to have nightmares lasting forever. And then it's a communist guy. Communist guy who walks through walls. Oh, well, jeez. So, yeah. Actually, you know, I've got... this amuses me greatly. I have two pages of the original art from FF13, first appearance of the Red Ghost and his super apes. And I like to say that I have the very first appearance of the Watcher. It's only his feet from behind, you know, but it is the first panel the Watcher appeared in. Terry Austin has got the actual splash page that he appeared on, and he offered to trade it to me for one of those pages, because he liked the way the thing was drawn, inked by Ditko. And I said, yeah, but I like the way the thing is inked by Ditko. I don't want to give this up. That was mind-boggling when I was, what would I have been, 12, 13? No, it was 13. And Kirby inked by Ditko was
just... Is it credited that way? I don't think I knew that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it says Kirby and Ditko.
Yeah.
And I also have a page... from Strange Tales Annual number 2, which is also Kirby inked by Ditko. And my art dealer, Jim Warden, a few years ago was visiting with his son. And it was his son's 13th birthday. And I pointed to this page from Strange Tales Annual number 2. And I said, I bought this on my 13th birthday. I bought that issue on my 13th birthday. And I said, imagine if I could go back in time and say to myself, someday you will own this page. And my 13-year-old self would say, I own all of them. I just bought it.
You mentioned about Ditko and he just passed.
Yeah.
What did you take from his art that influenced yours, do you think?
I've always said Ditko's greatest strength was the quirkiness, that it was always just a little weird, and I tried to fold some of that. Laurie Sutton, who used to be Frank Miller's girlfriend, worked up at DC, and she met Ditko one time, and she just gushed, you know, you can't help it. And she said, "Oh, Mr. Ditko, nobody draws Limbo the way you do." And he said, "That's because they haven't been there." I have two other Ditko stories, as long as we're doing this. You remember the issue of the Fantastic Four I did where Reed fought Dr. Octopus? And he defeated him by kind of grabbing the chest plate and holding those wheels that Octopus used to use to drive the arms. And this big debate, sitting in Mark Grunewald's office with Howard Mackey and a bunch of other people, this big debate came up, does Octopus still have those wheels? You know, does it? And I said, well, it's never been established that they were taken away, you know. And so he said, well, DeFalco's writing Spider-Man right now. Let's go to DeFalco and ask him. So we go down the hall and stick our heads into DeFalco's office, and there's DeFalco, and there's somebody sitting over there. And we say, you know, this wheel's been, what do you think, Tom? And so Tom says, I don't know, what do you think, Steve? And the guy sitting over here was Ditko. And he looks up and he says, do whatever you want. And then about 6 months later, I'm walking down the corridor towards the elevator in the Marvel offices, and Steve Ditko gets off, comes toward me. He goes, hi, John. And I went, because Steve Ditko knows my name. And I've said since, he probably thinks I'm the rudest person in the world because I didn't just say, hi, Steve. Yeah, still think he's was an amazing artist.
Did you ever hear feedback from him on the times you inked him?
No, although I did hear a story that I assume is apocryphal, but I'm taking it to my grave, where somebody asked him what he thought about my Spider-Man. And he said, well, he's the only one who knows how to do Spider-Man right. Steve Ditko said that. Oh, please let that be true. What?
What is your favorite superhero costume design that you've done yourself?
Oh, myself? Superhero, I'd have to go with Vindicated.
Yes.
Or Guardian.
Yeah.
And for villains, I think Silver Banshee.
What about favorite and least favorite to draw?
Oh. Well, what's the name of that stupid...
Jack of Hearts.
Well, Jack of Hearts, who I only ever drew in one panel, and I said never again. But the guy who swipes everybody else's powers, the Master something or something Master? Taskmaster. Yeah, boy, that's a female dog to draw.
Just a follow-up. Silver Banshee's costume, do you consider that to be actual flames?
Yes. It's silver flame, and it should be, you know, doing this the whole time. Yeah. But that was my attempt to do a Dave Cockrum costume, too, because she's got the opera gloves and the thigh-high boots, which Dave did 500 times, and every time he did it, it looked different. You know, it was like, oh, Storm has the same costume as, you know, Corsair, you know, it's like. Yes.
Can you share with us the creative process about the collaborative cult plotting of X-Men in the 70s? How did that work between you and Claremont?
You just asked a very complex question. When I first got on X-Men, I was strictly Art Robot. Chris used to send me 15-page plots for 17-page stories. You know, they were essentially scripts that weren't broken down in script form. And progressively, I started taking on more and more and more and more until Roger Stern and I figured out how to work Chris. And then I would suggest something to Chris, and he'd think it was his idea. And Roger would suggest something to Chris, and he'd think it was his idea. And there came a point where Chris actually said, not long before I left, that he felt he was losing control, that it was all becoming me. and to many degrees, it really was. We stopped doing written plots. We would do phone plots. We'd run up Marvel's bill, phone bill. And we'd work out a story. Chris would have all his Chris stuff that he wanted to put in it. And then I would sit down and draw what I remembered, because I figured if I didn't remember it, it doesn't need to be in here. And you can see Chris putting his stuff in sometimes. I've often pointed out that a Chris trope is large shot of close-up of somebody, Cyclops, and there's a big balloon above him that's coming in from off-panel, and he's saying, yes, you know, because that was Chris writing in, you know, his stuff. I was rereading some of this stuff for this X-Men thing I hadn't done. I was rereading the introduction of Kitty Pryde, where they take her to the soda shop and Storm is sitting talking to her, and I suddenly realized that Kitty says, well, me, and then Storm has two panels worth of, yes, I grew up in Africa, but if I hadn't, perhaps I would have been like Kitty and I would have done this. Well, I go, what does this have to do with anything? Chris, what are you doing? Yeah, so it was a barely a collaboration, really, by the end, you know, by the time I left. You haven't asked anything.
You mentioned 1977. Yeah. What's something in that era of that you worked in where you created so much that you think is missing in today's comics?
I do. I think 1977, 78 was just an amazing period. It's one of those times when Alan Davis refers to people getting assigned to books, he refers to it as casting, having the right casting. And in those days, in that period and up through the 80s, let's say there's about a five-year period there where you have Walt Simonson on Thor, Roger Stern on Doctor Strange and the Avengers. You've got Chris on X-Men. You've got me on the Fantastic Four. It was like suddenly everybody had fallen into exactly the right slot. And then strangely enough, just a few years later, it was as if everybody had taken one step to the right and we weren't doing the right books anymore. You know, still good stuff, but like it wasn't the perfect casting that it had been. Yeah, and that's, you know, the late 70s, before any of you were born. Yeah, bastards.
All the way in the back.
Pressure freedom did you have when you
got
to reset Superman with Man of Steel?
Mm. When I was hired to, or asked to do Superman, they asked me to turn in a proposal. And I turned in, I think it was 20 points, which I called my list of unreasonable demands. And some of you may have seen the Sci-Fi Channel interview that I did, so you've already heard this. And of the things I wanted to do, the only thing that DC, that Jeanette Kahn, pushed back on was that as I tell it, I was sitting there going, Kryptonite can kill Superman. How do we know that? That's kind of a test of destruction, isn't it? How do we know Kryptonite can kill Superman? So I came up with the idea that it wasn't Kal-El who was sent from Krypton. It was the pregnant Lara. This was before I did the big change with Paul Weston. She arrives on Earth. Kents find her. They take her home. She has the baby. And then she finds a lump of kryptonite. It kills her. So now we know the kryptonite can kill Kryptonians. And Jeanette didn't like that. She thought that was, of all the stuff I wanted to do, that was too extreme. And she said, what if the pressures in the core that are going to cause the planet to explode are already creating kryptonite? So people are dying of kryptonite radiation on Krypton, you know, before it blows up. And I said, I'll steal that. That's good. I'll take it, you know. So we did that instead, and that's how I got my Out of the Green Dawn title and all that stuff. Yeah. And then that persuaded me to do the cold antiseptic Krypton instead of the Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers Krypton. Yes, sir.
Was work the impetus for abandoning Canada?
No. Marriage was the impetus for abandoning Canada. I married an American lady, and she had two kids, and they were Americans. You know, I said, I can't bring them to Canada. My God. So I lapsed and became a damn Yankee. In 1988, I became a damn Yankee. And funnily enough, years later, I'm divorced and all this, and I was indulging in those things that crazy old men do, and I was dating a girl who was 20 years old. And she had been born in 1988. And I said, so we became Americans the same year. Yeah, well, you haven't asked anything, have you?
Yeah, thanks. To take you back to Superman with your 20 points there, you took him down several pages.
Yeah.
Was that your idea as well to do that?
I went into Superman saying, you know, it's the man that's important, not the Superman, not the super. And the super had really gotten... Well, Denny O'Neill once said to me, long before I got anywhere near Superman, he once said, it's hard to write interesting stories about a character who is so powerful he can destroy entire alien races by listening hard. And I said, yeah, you know? And the Superman movie with Christopher Reeve, the first one, which I saw 127 times in the theater. That is not an exaggeration. That is the number of times I saw it. And it struck me that every time I saw it, he's doing all this super stuff, you know, pushing over mountains and whatnot. But the moment the audience cheered every single time was when he tore the car door off to get to Lois. And I said, that's relatable. I mean, who among us hasn't had that moment? That's something we can all comprehend. And I said, that's why he needs to be Superman, but not Superman who can push the earth around. And when I was a kid, I used to have problems with that image too, because I would always think, well, they draw it sideways, so he's doing this. But he's standing on his hands, isn't he? You know, to push the earth. And why doesn't he just bore into the earth? So I said, let's bring it down and let's make it comprehensible. And I also tried to introduce some science so that his X-ray vision, for example, was not him firing X-rays out of his eyes. I said, that's not how X-rays work. If he was doing that, he'd have to fly around the other side to intercept it. I said, he can see the whole spectrum. You know, he can see X-rays. That's how he can see through stuff. You know, he can probably see radio waves. You know, that's... So, I thought about getting rid of heat vision because that wasn't a natural extension of what people can do, but I found it useful.
Have you... any Superman stories left, or did you tell them all?
Oh, I could tell some more Superman stories, probably, but I really feel it's a case of been there, done that. You know, once you do Superman, you almost feel like your career's over once you've done Superman. You know, it's like, well, nothing left here. So, yeah, I don't think I'd ever put that.
What about more Alpha Flight
stories? Yeah. Alpha Flight. Alpha Flight. I have to say, in all honesty, of all the books I've worked on, Alpha Flight probably interested me the least, which was kind of a surprise. You know, here's these characters that I created, my babies. And when I realized that I was having most fun killing them, people said, you know, why did you kill Guardian? And I said, well, because he was the least interesting character, but his death made the most interesting stories. And then, of course, there's that weird thing that happened after I left, where, well, it was Bill Mantlo. He seemed to think it was the book where people died. And he also seemed to think he had to fix everybody. So, like Box, you know, suddenly gets his legs and whatnot, and Puck is actually, you know, 6 feet tall. The Puck origin issue that he did was officially the last one I read. I said, okay, not my characters anymore. That's good. We're done. And then they brought back Guardian with the story that I had done, where he's whipped off the planet Phonebone, you know, and I said, it was a funny thing about that. I killed Guardian, and then I brought him back. And I brought him back in a way that I thought was so obviously fake. I thought, I'm never going to get away with this. Nobody's going to buy it. Because he says, oh yes, just before the suit bamfed, I was taken away to the moon of Jupiter or whatever. And I said, well, people are going to come after me because they're going to say, no, the suit blew up. And he took a step forward and he said, Heather, and then he fell down. So clearly this is not what happened. And I realized that people so wanted Guardian back that they accepted anything that I told them. And so, you know, the big reveal with Delphine Courtney and all this stuff was pissed people off, basically.
It was a traumatic death, man.
It was a traumatic death, you know? That countdown, Archie Goodwin. Complimented me on that countdown. Yes, sir.
Another Alpha Flight question. Is there any connection or inspiration between Guardian and Richard Calmley's Captain Canuck?
Not at all. No. Guardian was actually a fan character. I had created Guardian, I'm going to say something around 1968, I had created Guardian. Long before Captain Canuck, yeah.
Cool.
And then I saw Captain Canuck and said, okay, I have to change the costume. And then I designed what I still consider, as I said, one of my best costumes. And all I did was fold the flag, for crying out loud.
No,
you look at it and you realize the number of people who cannot draw that flag. And when you look at these artists who draw, it's like it's flames, it's lightning bolts. And no, it's just a... It's a maple leaf, guys. If you peel it up, it's a fleur-de-lis. But it's a maple leaf. Yeah. Who's...
Red shirt.
Back when you were doing Action Comics as your team-up book,
yeah.
Is there anyone you didn't get a chance to use that you wanted to use?
Swamp Thing.
Oh, yeah? Ooh. And then also, any comments on the Superman Barda sex tape?
Are you familiar with an old story called The Lady or the Tiger? Okay, the whole point of that story was this guy has fallen in love with a princess. It's set in India. And the king doesn't approve, the Raja doesn't approve. So he condemns the man to be put into an arena. And there are two doors. And behind one door is a lady, a beautiful princess, who he will marry if he opens that door. And behind the other door is a tiger. And if he opens that door, he's dead. So the princess that he's in love with is sitting above this, and she points at one of the doors. And that's where the story ends. So we don't know. What did he choose? What did she tell him? Did she tell him the lady or the tiger? And that was what I wanted to do with Barda. And Superman and Barda was, well, we don't know. You know, did they have sex? I don't know. You know, it's so you sit there and go, I don't know. Let's think about that. Sir?
Isn't the tiger just a quicker death?
Well, yeah. But the lady might be more pleasant.
Wait, why did you never use Swamp Thing?
They wouldn't let me. I went to the editor and I said, I want to use Swamp Thing in Action Comics. And she said, no, we can't allow that to happen. Oh, by the way, we're using Luther. And I said, well, I don't want that to happen because I haven't, you know, fully developed Luther yet. Oh, it's already done. Oh, okay. That's why we're going to play that game, is it? Fine. So I didn't get to do Swamp Thing. You. Oh, you. Yeah, you. The black gentleman with the hat.
So we were talking about 1977.
Yeah.
I remember that very well. I remember the whole era. Why was the television show of Spider-Man so horrible? The one that they did it. Why was that so bad?
Stan said something brilliant. He said, the Hulk worked because they didn't try to do the comic. And Spider-Man failed because they did. And I think that sums it up exactly. You know, they were trying to do the comic, but they didn't have the budget, they didn't have the anything.
Because Wonder Woman also worked. They were all on the same night.
Well, Wonder Woman had Linda Carter. You know, she could read a dictionary and I'd be fine with that.
I was outside Comic-Con this year with a friend, and his son was dressed up as Spider-Man, and this older man walked up to us, and he kneels down to the kid and says, I'm Nicholas Hammond. I played Spider-Man on the TV show. I love your costume. Uh-huh. And we have no idea if he was just a crazy person or if that was actually... We just got away really quickly, but it might have been Nicholas.
Sure. This reminds me of something unrelated that I want to share with this audience. I have gotten to know Cure Delay over the years because he lives in my area and whatnot. He doesn't remember me, which is really fascinating. We've met 17 times. And the last time we met was at a birthday party for a friend of mine, and I sat with Cure and had this long talk about his career and Space Odyssey and all this. And he tells this wonderful story about when they were filming Space Odyssey in England, in London. And Douglas Rain, who was the voice of Hal, was the last person hired. Nobody on that movie except Kubrick actually worked with Douglas Rain. He came in, the whole movie was finished, he did 4 hours of work, and that was Hal. Well, they needed somebody to read the Hal lines so the actors could react. And as Keir tells it, so Kubrick had his assistant director read the lines. So Keir would say, open the pod bay door, Hal. And he'd hear, well, sorry, Dave, I'm afraid I can't do that. I wish they'd kept that voice. Dave? Dave? What are you doing, Dave? I feel my mind is going.
Way in the back.
Actually, I hear Chewbacca was a little like that Star Wars voice.
Yes.
You created the next men. Which of them was your favorite?
Jazz.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it was fairly obvious, actually. Because, you know, you always hurt the one you love. And I think I did all the worst. Which, you know, Danny got eaten by a dinosaur. Okay, so that's pretty bad. But I did such terrible stuff to get to poor Jazz. Yeah. Yes?
I know during your days working on the X-Men, I personally love your version of Wolverine's costume. Mm. And I know you had to change it while working on it. I guess, what was your thoughts about, you know, the change of the costume and which, I guess, version of the costume, I guess, going forward, you know.
You're asking why I changed Wolverine's costume, is that the question?
And which version, you know, I guess, do you like?
Well, I prefer the brown one. I mean, that was my version. And the reason I changed it was there are no yellow and blue Wolverines, unless they're football players in Michigan, which was actually the inspiration. You know, Len's, oh, the Michigan Wolverine, sure, let's have, you know. Canadian character. There's a funny thing about that. Chris named Wolverine Logan, as you know, without knowing that the tallest mountain in Canada is Mount Logan. He didn't know. I said, oh, that's cool. You did that. What? And then, of course, you know, that got fixed. In the way you fix cats. Yes. Yeah. Sir.
Days of Future Past, it's called Matt Bayrick, two-parter. Mm. Just a question. What was your take? What do you think about it?
Well, they haven't filmed Days of Future Past.
That's what I
Where did Kitty get this new power to send people through time? How does that connect to walking through a wall? And by the way, something I'm touching on in this X-Men book I'm not doing. Kitty's power is not to swim through matter. She doesn't sort of have it part and go around her. Her atoms go between the atoms of the matter. She controls valences. So, as I pointed out, if she grabbed Juggernaut and pulled him down into the floor and then let go of him, he would be what we call dead. You know, he wouldn't be just stuck in the floor so he could flex and break free. He'd be part of the floor. Yeah. So, yeah. It's like, how can you not get that? How can you lose that so fast? Oh, well. You, sir.
I had read somewhere that when you worked at DC, you wanted to do something with Hawkman, and it never came about. And I wondered if that was true, and yeah, what your plans for Hawkman were.
I had a whole... I had a great love of Hawkman ever since the Joe Kubert days. Picked up the first Silver Age Hawkman from a magazine flat at the end of an aisle in a grocery store. And the opening scene in the first Hawkman story with the little dog who turns into a bear scared the out of me. You know, I was, 9 or 10 or 11 years old? So I'd always wanted to do Hawkman. And Hawkman was so messed up when I was there, and since. And I came up with this whole thing to fix Hawkman. And we were rolling along on it, and then DC said, no, we're going to have this guy do it. And I said, okay, fine. I can do something else. I kept asking for the demon, and it took like 15 years for them to give me the demon. No, you haven't asked anything, have you?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, with current books that are out there, is there anything you still follow or enjoy?
No. I honestly really shouldn't be as critical as I am, because I honestly haven't read a comic book other than reprints, 25 years. But what I notice is that when people, like on my website or anywhere else, I go, when people talk about how great some comic is, oh, this issue of blah, it's so great. And the way they describe it, I find myself thinking, no, I would hate that. You know, so clearly, I don't have to read this to know that I would hate it, because you guys love it for the reason I would hate it. Yes.
You were a prolific writer as well as an artist, and you're recognized as both. And then you were part of the generation that saw everything go to like art first.
Yeah.
What was that like for you to be proficient in both and seeing it lean towards that?
You know, back when Todd McFarlane proved you could publish a monthly portfolio and actually make money at it. I've often said the image guys... Well, let me put it this way. I would always tell wannabe artists, your job is to make the writer redundant. Your job is to tell the story in the pictures so that we don't really need the writer to tell us what's going on. I was on a panel years ago with George Perez and Will Eisner, and I was making exactly this speech, and I said, you know, the only time you'll need a writer is if it has to be 4:30 in the afternoon, because you can't draw 4:30 in the afternoon. And I went, no, wait a minute. Mr. Eisner could draw 4:30 in the afternoon, because he could draw anything. So I tell people, artists, one of the artists, make the writer completely unnecessary. And I think that's what the image guys did. But the wrong way. You know? It's like, no.
Not right. No.
I think that's why Chris got so verbose on my stuff, because he had nothing to do. I covered everything, so he'd write about it as if I hadn't.
It's suppose this is a segue question to what you were talking about with Image. Was the Legend imprint within Dark Horse a response to the Image movement?
In many ways. We looked at Image and said, that's a good idea. And then we built Legend. And as Joe Duffy so aptly put it, it sure didn't take long for Legend to become myth. Yeah, that was unfortunate. What can I say? Jim Lee had actually asked me to join Image. And I had just signed with Dark Horse to do X-Men. He said, well, what does that matter? Come and do it with us. And years later, I thought, you know, if I'd done that, I would be a multi-millionaire. But I would have to have all the mirrors taken out of my house. You, sir.
What's the one character you haven't drawn or written for that you'd like to?
Well, on a regular basis. I mean, I've done just about everybody as a guest star. But on a regular basis, Doctor Strange. I would love to take a turn with Doctor Strange. For years, I didn't want to because I didn't think I was right for it. I didn't think I could figure him out. And then it sort of fell into place one day. And I went, oh, yeah, I could do Doctor Strange. It was one of the reasons I had him guest star in Namor. Because I said, this is what I would do with Doctor Strange. Yeah. And there was a wonderful bit I wanted to steal from Roger Stern. He mentioned it, but never got around to doing it. I think I made reference to it in the Namor appearance, where people would say, well, how come if we go down to to Greenwich Village, you know, that house isn't really there? And Roger said, well, it is, but you can only see it if you need to. And this is why Wong will always answer the door, because if the doorbell rings, it's somebody who needs to be there, needs to see the house. Like, that's brilliant. But if you're walking along, you don't need Dr. Strange. It's a parking lot. Okay.
It's been great having you at Fan Expo this year. I guess going forward...
I got to be somewhere.
Correct. Going forward, are we going to see you at more conventions?
No. This may be my latest last convention. Latest in a set. Collect them all.
Is just gonna push us down into the ground.
Are you talking about comics published in Canada?
Yeah. Are we ever?
Well, they were, you know, once upon a time. Yeah. The Canadian Whites, as they were called, which had some truly bizarre characters. There was a guy called Major Domo, who was a very tall, strong man who had no arms and who had a dwarf riding on his shoulders. It was almost Master Blaster, you know? It was like, and that was a character. And then, of course, there was Nelvana of the Northern Lights, who is secretly Snowbird's mother. She was a real god, goddess Nelvana, so when I was doing the origin of Snowbird. But I don't know what it is. I mean, the superhero specifically is such an American concept. It's the American inferiority complex that creates the superhero. And I mean, look at Superman. He is so American. He's a foreigner who comes to America and becomes greater in America than he ever could have anywhere else. I mean, that's the ultimate American success story. Except, you know, they're not allowed to be foreigners anymore. I was saying the other day, on a tangent, we can all look forward to Donald Trump's second term, because the only way the Democrats will beat him is if they run Jesus H. Christ, and they can't run him because he's a foreigner.
And I kind of think with that. Wait, did you have one last? We have time for one last question.
Were you aware that Brian Michael Bendis killed Alpha Flight?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what did you think of that?
Who cares? if it's the same story, I remember seeing a double page spread or something of a mole lying dead in the snow.
Yeah.
And there's Guardian with his costume torn and his, you know, bare flesh. And I looked at that and I thought, well, he might have stood a better chance if he'd worn the battle suit that goes under the costume. You know? So,
yeah, I don't know. I mean,
when you create something and then you leave it, you do it as work for hire, and you walk away from it at some point, you have to walk away from it and say, you know, I mean, my spider woman was turned into a crack whore. And remember Nudge and Grunt, who I created for Doom Patrol? And they had, that was the gorilla guy with the kid's brain and the girl who could make people do stuff. And they had him, they had the gorilla literally tear her apart. And I thought, well, I bet that's just a coincidence. You know, that's not just deliberately trashing my characters. So ultimately, I don't care. You know, I'll go create somebody else, I'll move on. Oddly enough, a couple of years ago, Lab Rats. Remember that one? Anybody read that?
Yeah.
Just you, yeah. You're the one. You're the one. But the rights to that reverted to me for some weird reason. Like DC sent me this thing saying, yeah, you own Lab Rats now. And I thought, well, if you told me that before Disney did a series called Lab Rats, I might actually have been able to do something with it. But we don't want to mess with the mouse. Oh, let me just tell a little tiny story that goes along with that. I've been getting some really good checks from Marvel. Not to boast, but like six-figure checks from Marvel. And I was talking to a friend of mine about this, going, why am I suddenly getting, you know, money for stuff that was done work made for hire? So technically, they don't owe me anything on it. And we're trying to figure out why. And we sort of looked at each other and said, Disney. Disney owns Marvel, and they're trying to cross all the T's and dot all the lowercase J's, avoiding what is called the Peggy Lee effect. I don't know if you know about Peggy Lee, who years after the fact, she wrote songs and performed in Lady and the Tramp. And then when they started putting it out on laser discs and DVDs and CDs, she sued for, you know, more money. Give me more money. You use it. And she won. And so I did a mouse cover 10, 15 years ago. Just, okay, that's off my bucket list. I've done a mouse cover. But they sent me the Disney contract. And I said, I think I better read this, you know, because they might end up owning my grandchildren. And it had a passage in it that I will never, ever forget. It's the Peggy Lee passage. It says, copyright throughout the universe, in all forms known and yet to be invented. And this is why, you know, they're sending me nice checks now, even on stuff they really don't have to. So I say, thank you. Thank you. Oh, look at that. Yeah, one more.
You haven't been following the comic books. Have you been following the Marvel and DC cinematic universes? And what do you think of those?
Well, again, I don't think they have filmed any of the Marvel and DC stuff, honestly. I thought the first Iron Man was wonderful. Just everything was right about it. And then that went off the rails. And then, of course, the first X-Men movie, that wonderful line about yellow spandex that fans in the audience laughed at.
Yeah.
And I said, I said, number one, not spandex. This is one of the things that frustrates me the most in the world. It has become this thing to refer to superhero costumes as being made out of spandex. Pause for a moment and tell me one superhero whose costume is made out of spandex. Anybody?
She-Hulk.
No. Well, she might occasionally wear, you know, but I don't think her costume is given to her by Reed Richards. It's unstable molecules. That's not spandex, you know? And when they refer to Iron Man as wearing spandex, I go, oh, God. Are you missing the point or what? Superman is wearing spandex. Well, Christopher Reeve wore spandex, but where does the costume come from? You know, did Jor-El and Lara pick up some Kryptonian spandex to send along? So that's one of the things in the world that bugs me more than I can begin to describe.
Oh, yes, these guys with spandex costumes.
No. Possibly Spider-Man's costume is spandex because it's homemade, right? But, and I once infuriated people online by suggesting that Luke Cage's pants were spandex.
No, it can't be.
What else would it be? Mm-hmm. So I think we're done anyway, so thank you.
So we might be done for that panel, but I've got more footage. So just go to the next episode, press download. You're going to get John Byrne Part 2. That was the Sunday panel coming up. Thank you for listening to this one. If you enjoyed the show, email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Leave us a review on iTunes. And we got a lot more footage coming your way from this year's Fan Expo 2018. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And hurry up and press download for the next episode, guys.